Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanand Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. There are so many levels of what can be done to help people who suffer. Whether they're people who are suffering in this country, whether they're people who are suffering in other countries, whether they're suffering from poverty, whether they're suffering from illness. And there's so many different levels. There's, of course, what you call the grand level, the highest level, which has to do with programs and legislation that gets put in place, for example, at the highest level. Looking at and changing legislation that enables some people to just keep pocketing more and more and more and more and more while so many people have nothing. But of course, since we live in democratic societies, that has to be a collective decision. We can't stand here and say, here's what needs to be done. Rather, what we do is we inspire and educate the public so that hopefully people will, when voting for their people who are going to serve them on the grand level, who are going to make laws, who are going to make programs, who are going to institute policies that impact the poor people, we hope that we will vote for those who will do the right thing rather than those who will just continue to put more money back into my pocket. And this is interestingly where spirituality and politics meets in some way. Because on the one hand, they say, well, you know, spirituality shouldn't get involved in politics. On the other hand, spirituality is so deeply rooted in the concept of the world as a family, so deeply rooted in the concept of us all as one, so rooted in concepts of equality, that to have a situation that's so clearly separate and not one is a great challenge for spiritual leaders, for spiritual teachers. But it's not about dictating to the government what they should do, because the government are responsible to the people who have voted them in office. We can't have a situation where the government starts doing what the religious leaders tell them to do. But the role that spirituality plays is in helping the public get over their own selfishness, get over feelings of separation, get over feelings of scarcity, get over feelings of fear that make them vote for someone who they know is going to pull money out of wherever it needs to be pulled just so it can end up back in my pocket. And so that's a role actually that we take very seriously, because we are a democratic society, and so none of us gets to say, well, here's how it should be, here's how it needs to be. But when collectively we come together and say, we don't want to see this anymore, then we have power. Then we really have power, because the truth is, it's not rocket science. Building schools, building training programs, employing people. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. We know how to do this. It's not like we're looking at global warming and suddenly for the first time in, you know, recorded human history, scientists are figuring out how to put more, you know, water into clouds, or they're trying to figure out how to cool the atmosphere or plug up holes in the ozone layer. Like, that's rocket science. But what to do with poverty? Well, we know what to do with poverty. We know the role that education plays. We know the role that training plays. We know the role that empowerment plays. So we don't need another, you know, billion-dollar think tank on what to do with poverty. What we need is a voting public, a decision-making public, those who have the luxury to choose what to do with their dollars or rupees or euros or pounds, making conscious choices that are choices made with an awareness of oneness, an awareness of equality, rather than that are made in greed and separation and fear and myth of scarcity and all of that, which is why the whole importance of the spiritual movement in this is so important. Because, yeah, on the one hand, we just personally as an organization feed people, we provide medical care, we provide free school, we provide free training. I mean, we do all of that. But you can never do it all. You can never do enough. And that's why the spiritual side of it is also so important, because through that, you're able to create a much bigger ripple effect. You're able to inspire and touch others who also then are going to go out, and then maybe they're going to feed people and provide medical care and do education and do training and bring in sanitation and hygiene or whatever their area requires. But that's where the movement of spirituality is so crucial and is so intricately linked and not separate from politics. If we keep it separate, then we just keep living in separation. We need to bring in that consciousness of oneness, the fact that, you know, as we always say, your hunger is my hunger, your thirst is my thirst, your pain is my pain. And if we can help people through meditation, through prayer, through satsang, through whatever it is, through yoga, attain some level of an experience of their connection to the world, their connection to planet Earth, well, then maybe I'm going to think 200 times before eating or wearing or buying something that requires trees to be cut down, or that requires animals to be slaughtered, or that requires food to be pulled out of the hands of hungry people, or that requires political leaders who are going to pull money out of those programs to put them in my pocket. So on an individual level, I'd say do as much as you can. There's no right place to start. There's obviously lots to be done. Support those who are also doing it as much as you can. And try to touch and teach all of those you know in whatever capacity you have to also inspire them to do the same. But again, not from a place of separateness, not from a place of, look, guys, you know, those really poor people, we should do something to help them. I mean, that's nice. Sympathy is a good thing. Pity is a good thing. But spiritually, we really want to try to bring people to compassion, which is much more of a connection than us over here with the money serving them over there who don't have it. And aren't we so great? And shouldn't you, you know, applaud us and give us gold stars and awards for being so generous? Compassion is much more the awareness that I have no more right to this than you do. It could be me over there and you over here, because we're all part of the same creation. And just at this moment, in this very little intersection of time and space. I'm playing the role of the one who has, and you're playing the role of the one who hasn't, in order to give me the opportunity to play the role of the one who gives. And you oblige me by playing the role of the one who takes. But it comes from a much deeper place. And then not only do I benefit from the sense of feeling like, oh, I'm such a good person, I gave, but I benefit on a much, much deeper spiritual level. Because now I've actually had an experience of connection with something beyond just me.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single...
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Aliyah, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's rain.org.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me. Really, the key to making decisions is not so much about what to do, but about who am I? And our confusion about what to do comes with a confusion of who we are. Once we really are connected to a sense of who we are, then knowing what to do comes much more easily. And also, once we realize that the purpose of our life is not in the roles we're playing. The purpose in our life has to do with what I awaken to, what I experience, how much I'm able to live as love, as consciousness, as awareness, as soul, as spirit. And the truth is, you can pretty much do that in almost every city, in almost every career choice. But because we have gotten brainwashed into believing that the purpose of our life has to do with the role we play. So the purpose of my life, if I'm a mother, becomes to take care of my children. The purpose of my life, if I'm a teacher, becomes to teach. The purpose of my life, if I'm a doctor, is to treat. The purpose of my life, if I'm a gardener, is to tend to the plants. Purpose of my life, if I'm a cook, is to cook. But no, those are just the roles we play. And they have nothing to do with the purpose of our life. But we get so caught up in thinking that I've got to figure out the purpose of my life, and is it the cook, or is it the lawyer, or is it the doctor, or is it the teacher, or is it the mother, or is it the mother and the doctor, or the mother, you know, I could do the mother, I could do the doctor, I could do the cook, why not, I can do all three of them. And then the purpose of my life becomes just to stay sane. Because I'm trying to simultaneously be a mother and a doctor and a cook at the same time and a gardener. But I've wrapped my sense of awareness of who I am so much in what I do that no wonder it's confusing. And no wonder it rips our heart out, the concept of maybe making the wrong decision becomes about my entire life. And the truth is, the only wrong decision you can make is to not awaken, to not look within, to not shift focus from the outer world to the inner world, to not live from the heart. And when we say from the heart, of course, I don't mean your impulses and your desires and your, you know, instincts, but really from love. That's the purpose of our life. And the reason that you know that is any career, at most, you've got it for a few decades. At most, even if you're one of those people who goes through school knowing exactly what they want to do, get the job in their 20s, well, all right, so at most you do this for what, 30, 40 years? It's barely half your life. We've got all this life prior to our career, all this life post-retirement. Well, if who I am, if the purpose of my life is that career, well, what about the other half of my life? What about the hours I'm not at my job? And so it's a very, very tricky and sticky way to try to think about your purpose. But that's what gives the sense of desperation to decisions. Because it's not just about this city or this job or that job. It's about my life and purpose. And the minute that you can actually recognize the purpose of my life is to know who I am. Not in the role. Not who I am as doctor or cook or mother or lawyer or gardener. But who I am as soul. Who I am as spirit. Who I am as essence. Who I am as love. Who I am as divine being. And you can do that as a doctor. You can do it as a gardener. You can do it as a mom. You can do it as a cook. You can do it as anything. But those are all just roles that we play. And the truth is, yeah, some of us are going to be better at certain ones than others. Just like in a school play, you know, the one who can sing gets the singing role. The one who can dance gets the dancey role. The one who had a growth spurt a little bit early gets to play the villain because he's, you know, head and shoulders taller than anybody else. But they're just roles based on aspects of what we have. But we all understand. Well, he's not really the villain. And she's not really that, and he's not really that. It's just she gets to play that role because she can sing. He gets to play that role because he can dance. He gets to play that role because he's really handsome. You know, I mean, in a play I remember that we did when I was, God, probably kindergarten, maybe early elementary school. I was probably 6 or 7. My hair used to be even much more curly than it is now. And I was given the role of Medusa in a play that we did, who has, you know, hair that's out of hair of made of snakes. And in order to play the role, I had to bend my head over, and the head of the drama department or whoever was doing this play with us in kindergarten or first grade brushed out all my hair from the bottom so that when I flipped my head up, it literally went straight out like 3 feet in every direction. And the point is, it wasn't that I was any more like this character or that character, but whoever was planning it looked at me and said, "This girl has got the hair to be Medusa." And you couldn't say, "Ah, well, that's the purpose of my life." It had nothing to do with purpose of life. It has to do with the type of hair I had. And this is where, when we think about careers and jobs, and I'm not trying to make light of it. Anything that you're going to do for that many decades is something that certainly deserves thought and attention and care. But it's not the decision of the purpose of your life. And as long as we're able to keep those separate, as long as we're able to understand, well, these are decisions that I'm making about roles that I want to play. Do I want to play that role or play this role? It's a drama and we get to decide. Do you want to be the villain? Do you want to be the singer? Do you want to be the dancer? Do you want to be Medusa? We get to choose. But none of it has anything to do with our purpose. The purpose is waking up. And the purpose is living deeply as who we are. And so the more and more you can connect to that, the more the life decisions are going to come much more easily. Because when you know who you are, you know what to do. You know, I always say that the dogs never jump off the balcony after the birds because the bird flew and the dog thinks, well, the bird did it, I can also do it. Somehow intuitively, the dog understands, I'm not a bird. No matter how many birds it watches fly, it never jumps off the rooftop. Nothing in nature messes up who it is. Dogs eat dog food, cats eat cat food, monkeys eat monkey food. They don't, you know, you never see a bird going moo. Got confused, thought it was a cow for a little while. Was around too many cows, it sort of picked up cow-like tendencies. It never happens. Because they know what they are. And our deepest problem is we don't know who we are. And so we start identifying based on these roles we play, which in most cases weren't decided by us. They were given to us at the age when I was Medusa. I mean, can you imagine if I had grown up believing I really was Medusa? Like how my life would have been so different. But most of the roles that we get given, the smart one, the stupid one, the pretty one, the ugly one, the good one, the bad one. You know, these are roles that we get given in families, in school, in society. And then we live according to them. But it would be as ridiculous as me living my life, who are you, Medusa? I just had the hair and the teacher, you know, gave me the part. I had these very big long fingernails that I remember falling off me in the middle of the play. But it has nothing to do with who you are. So let that be your focus, rather than the focus being on making decisions. Focus on who you are. And then what to do will come very, very easily and very naturally. And when it doesn't, you'll make a decision and either way will be right. The wisdom, this is the last point, the wisdom very frequently comes not so much in the decision itself, but in how we live with the decisions that have been made. Because many times wisdom comes after we've made the decision. We don't get to have all the experiences before we choose. In many cases, we have to make a choice. You know, it's like you walk into an ice cream parlor for the very first time. 31 flavors, but you have no idea what strawberry tastes like. You have no idea what vanilla is like. You have no idea what chocolate's like. Well, you've got to make a choice. And in life, we have to make decisions very frequently without having tasted all the options, without knowing what they're all like. And so you do your best, you make a decision, but the wisdom in many cases comes afterwards. Well, all right, so now this is the decision that has been made. How can I utilize this decision, utilize this path I'm now on to awaken, to grow, to get more in touch with myself? So that's the place that wisdom for many of us comes in. How can I make this the right decision? Whether it was or not, when I was making it, is irrelevant. How can I make the decision I made into the right decision?
This is OTRFM, part of the iOM radio network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with inspiration and transformation. Why do sad, negative feelings stay with me so much longer than the happy and positive ones? When I feel happy and blissful, I wish I could just bottle it. But somehow it seems very short-lived. And it is taken over by feelings of sadness, frustration, and anger. This is very common. And the reason for that is if you look at the cause of the feelings of happiness and bliss and the cause of the frustration and sadness. So our causes, in most cases, of our happiness and bliss is something that we get from outside. We were studying for an exam. We take the exam. We do really well. We're very happy. We were looking forward to a party. We go to the party. We really enjoy it. We're very happy. We have something nice to eat that we like, whether it's a cookie, whether it's pizza, whether it's mom's special food, whatever it is. We think about it, we love it, finally we get it, we enjoy. But all of these things don't last very long. A meal is over in 20 minutes, half an hour if we really linger, a party's a couple of hours. The exuberance we feel after doing well on an exam or doing well at something at work is inevitably short-lived because right after that, we have to start learning things for our next exam. They don't let you ride very long on one exam in school. One exam is over and then it's okay. Now learn the stuff for the next exam. Same at work. You do something really well. You do a project that was great. You feel wonderful. But then it's business as usual. Back to the work. And so the things that give us that happiness and that give us that bliss, because we're getting it from things outside, it's not going to last. And then why does the frustration and sadness last so long? Well, because again, what we've told ourselves is, until and unless I get that which makes me happy, I'm not happy. So until I have another one of mom's great meals, or until I get another of those pizzas or another of those cookies, or until I'm sure that I'm going to do well on my next exam as well, we're anxious, maybe we're frustrated, we're worried. The other thing that happens is when happiness comes, as the questioner said, I wish I could bottle it. Now that's something we all feel. You have this beautiful moment, maybe a deep moment even. Maybe not even just a superficial, you know, food or exam or party moment, but a deep moment of bliss. And the first thing that comes to our mind is, oh my God, how can I hold on to this? Oh my God, this is going to go away. We fall in love, and the first thing we think is, oh my God, what if something happens to them? We have a child, great joy, but that joy is tempered so much by fear. Oh my God, what if they get run over by a car? They're going in the street. What if they eat this? What if they get sick? Why are they crying? So even bliss and joy that's deeper, it doesn't last, because what it does is, in our efforts to hold on to it and our efforts to make sure it doesn't go anywhere, we've brought in fear into the joy. And for those of us with overactive intellects and imaginations, you can actually get yourself in your mind already into the place where the loved one is sick or dead, where the child has been run over by the car, where something horrible has happened. And so here you are in this moment in which everything is perfect. Everything is there, but we're not even able to enjoy the real joy of the moment for very long, because our anxiety kicks in, our fear kicks in, our longing to hold on to it kicks in. And the truth is, nothing lasts forever. Everything has a cycle. You know, we talk so frequently about the waves of the ocean, and they go up and they go down. And if my happiness is connected to the going up wave on the ocean, then the minute that that wave goes down, I'm going to no longer be happy. And this is where the key is not how can I bottle my happiness. The key is not how can I make sure this doesn't end. Because, of course, in thinking that, I've already ended it. In trying to figure out how to bottle it up, in trying to figure out how to make sure that nothing happens to it, I've brought in the fear. I've brought in that sense of dissatisfaction. See, I have it now. But it's not enough. I need to have it tomorrow also. I need to have it next year also. And what that does is it brings an element of lack into a moment that is otherwise very full and a moment that is otherwise very, very blissful. What I've done is I've shifted my perspective from abundance to lack. And that's what removes the joy. The more I realize that this moment is not enough, I've got to make sure that it's still with me tomorrow, that it's still with me next week, that it's still with me next month, that it's still with me next year. Well, I've shifted the entire perspective from a feeling of, oh, everything is perfect, to a feeling of, it's not yet enough. Maybe if I have it also tomorrow, also next week, also next month, also next year, also forever, maybe if this thing never leaves me, maybe then it'll be enough. And what that reminds us on a very deep level is, it's never enough. There's always lack. And that, of course, brings us into depression and frustration and sadness. And so, in the moments of joy, live them fully. And I'll tell you a hint, a secret. A secret from science. spirituality has been telling us for thousands of years. Live in the moment, live in the moment, live in the moment. Be present, be present, be present. Be here now. But here's what neurology has taught that I find really interesting. If you actually want to hold on to a feeling, if the joy in this moment is so powerful that you want to make sure it's with you next week or next month, actually you have a way to do it. And the way to do it is to be so present here in this moment that it actually creates a pattern in the brain. This is why everybody knows where they were when something traumatic happened. So we all know where we were on 9/11. My mom's generation could tell you where they were when John F. Kennedy was shot. Whatever the tragic shocks that have taken place in our generation, everybody knows exactly where they were standing, exactly what the world looked like around them, on what was otherwise a very ordinary day. In your life, if you've had any sort of traumatic experience, something bad that's happened, inevitably you can remember every aspect of that day. If you had an accident, if a loved one has passed away, we remember the details like they were in front of us, even if it happened years ago. We remember in the morning we woke up and we had oatmeal for breakfast, and then he asked for a second cup of coffee, and I walked into the kitchen and I was still in my bathrobe and I was making the second cup of coffee, and just I put one sugar cube into it and I turned around and saw that he had had a heart attack, right? We remember that level of detail. Why? Because on a neurological level, when something very, very meaningful, very, very profound happens, everything surrounding it gets cemented into our consciousness. Cemented in. It's there forever. And so if you're in the midst of a moment of peace and joy and bliss, make sure that your mind is so present there. Make sure that you're fully 200% there and your mind isn't wandering someplace else. Cement that moment in your mind. What does it smell like? What does it look like? What does it sound like? So you're in a moment of joy. Well, all right, what can you hear? What can you smell? What do you see around you? Use your senses and literally cement that moment in. And it's actually neurologically the very best way to keep it with you. But on the emotional level, the minute that we recognize that the only joy that actually lasts is the joy that comes from within, not the joy that comes from the food or that comes from the party or that comes from anything else. The minute we recognize that is the source of joy, then we start focusing on that. Then rather than trying to bottle up the rest, we focus on finding a source that's endless. And that's always there.
This is OTRFM. Part of the iOM Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life. just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth Radio is conscious living for your soul, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Like Baldwin, with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip or the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation. Letting go. Well, this is something that we all struggle with. Whether it's a matter of letting go of a child as they go off to college, whether it's a matter of letting go of a parent as they pass on, whether it's a matter of letting go of an identity that we had that was wrapped up in a career that we had and now we're retiring and so we're no longer that identity. Whatever it is, letting go is always difficult. Letting go is always a challenge. And the only way to do it, especially in this case when you're looking at the child and he's going, is to recognize that you're always with him. You're always there. You may not be physically there, but that which you've given him is there in him. And also to recognize that he's being guided and led. There's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful poem by Khalil Gibran titled, I think it's just titled like On Children. And I'm not going to do it justice because I don't remember it word for word, but it speaks so beautifully about how your children have come through you but not of you. So we think of them as extensions of ourself. And in many ways, we've made that relationship. It's, you know, not just that we love them, but that they are sort of a piece of us. And he reminds us, they've come through you, but they're not of you. And goes on to emphasize what each child comes into this world with and how time moves always forward through the youth, through the children, that they're the ones who are pulling it forward. And he ends it by speaking about how, but don't worry, because God loves the bow from which the arrow comes as much as God loves the arrow that's flying through the sky. And it's a beautiful, beautiful metaphor. You should just Google it. I'm sure you'll find it really easily. It's On Children by Khalil Gibran. But the metaphor is so beautiful about how we've just been given this sacred opportunity to have them come through us. They're not of us. They never were ours. But we were given this beautiful opportunity to mold them, to have them, to be with them. And now, like the arrow that comes from the bow, it's going off in the world. But remember that where that arrow goes, this isn't part of the poem, this is my taking it now for you, is where that arrow goes is in large part, not 100%, but in large part based on the bow, the person who's pulling the bow. And so it's not that they're now out of our hands. It's not that we don't you know, have any of that connection you do. You're the one. You're the one who has literally molded them in the arrow and bow analogy, strung them up on the bow. You are the bow that's been pulled back. And the direction now that they're going is the direction that you've given them. And so to have faith in that, to have faith in knowing I've given them this direction, but also to remember they all come into this world with their own package. You know, the example that I always give is if you've got an apple seed, you may plant it in the most fertile ground, most wonderful ground. You may water it in the best way, shine the best sun on it. But if you were hoping for peaches, you're never going to get peaches out of that apple seed. The best you're going to get in the best soil, with the best water, with the best sun, is an apple tree. But if in your mind you were hoping for peaches, you're never going to get it, no matter how good the soil, how good the water, how good the rain, I mean, how good the sun, no matter how many peach mantras you chant over it, no matter how much you scold it and send it back to its room until it can come out as a peach, it's an apple seed. And so we hold both of those aspects together. One, the awareness that I am the bow that has strung it up, that has sent it on its way. I know the direction. We know where it's going because it's based on you. But it's also a seed that has come into this world with its own karmic package, its own dharma. It's not about letting go as in he's now gone forever. It's just letting go of the control. Letting go of that constant knowing of exactly where he is, which you're going to have to. Because if you start calling, you know, 20 times a day, then it becomes difficult. But letting go with the faith of knowing what you've filled this seed with and who that seed is. I'll tell you a personal story. When I first decided to come back to India, to move to India, I was 25. And as Pooja Swamiji was saying on the Ghat, I had graduated from Stanford. I was then in the midst of a PhD program and came to India traveling, had this incredible experience. Stayed for a few months. Swamiji made me go back for a while. But I knew I needed to be here. And everybody told me, you're making the worst mistake. You know, you shouldn't go. But I knew it was right. And I asked my dad how he felt. And because he's very, very calm, very beautiful, very divine. And he hadn't said much, and I wanted, you know, to just really alone find out from him how he felt about this. And he said, you know, in 25 years, because I was 25, he said, in 25 years, you've never made a decision that I think was the wrong decision. He said, I don't understand this decision, but just because I don't understand it, who am I to assume that suddenly you've started making wrong decisions? Which is an amazing, amazing thing for the father of a 25-year-old who's just announced that she's, you know, leaving her PhD and she's moving to live in an ashram in India to say. But I share the story with you because for me, that's really the most incredible, perfect ideal of parenting is I know you. I trust you. It's not about micromanaging every decision. It's not about asking you every day, who are you going out with? Where are you going? What time are you going to be home? What are you going to do? Is your homework done? You know, it's, I know you. You're my son. I trust you. Which means that the decisions that you make are the decisions that are going to be right for you. Doesn't mean they're going to be exactly the same decisions that you made when you were in college. College in America is very, very different. Really very different. It's going to be a completely different life from what you lived when you were in university. So the decisions are going to be different. But the sanskaras that you've given him, what you have, the water and the sun and the fertile soil for 20 years, he's going to be great. And my last piece of advice to you is, this is really the time to shift from being father to being friend. And what I mean by that is, he should feel free and open to tell you anything, especially because he's far. Because then what'll happen due to the distance, it's one thing when they're living at home. You see at dinner, Acha, why are you not speaking? Tell me what happened. They go in the room. Maybe you don't get the answer till breakfast, but they're under the same roof. But with the distance, if he has fear in his mind about sharing a concern, sharing a question, because maybe the context of it is not exactly something that he knows that you're going to like, so he's sort of afraid to tell you what he's got a question about or afraid to share something. You don't want that. You want him to know he can tell you anything. And you're not going to be mad. You're going to always love him. You're going to always support him so that he can feel free to talk to you, so that he doesn't wind up in, you know, the university counseling services to get advice from someone who doesn't even know him. Because he's afraid to talk to his parents because, oh my God, what if they, you know, don't approve and get mad? So really, before he goes, sit him down and have a conversation about, okay, we've done our best. We've done our best. For 20 years, we've whacked you like a potter whacks a piece of clay to become something. Now you've become. Now we want to support you. Share with us, tell us, we want to be close to you. So really, just keep those doors as open as you possibly can. And that's going to be hard, because there are going to be things he's going to tell you that your immediate instinct is going to be, oh my God. And that's fine between the two of you. When you hang up the phone, you can, you know, hold each other and cry and say, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. But don't say that to him. Let him feel, wow, I was so nervous to tell them, but oh my God, they were so supportive. Because then you can really guide him through difficult situations. He has to feel open enough to share the difficult situation with you. And from your side, just have that faith and just love him. And the truth is, it's not even really that much of a letting go, because these days with the communication, you're in touch constantly. You never had the level of control that you think you had anyway. That control is an illusion anyway. If he was wanting to do things, he would have done them. There's always a way. So just keep coming back to your faith. Just keep coming back to that faith of knowing what you've given him. And then open the channels in such a way that that relationship now, in its new way, just blossoms and blossoms and blossoms and blossoms. This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week, and I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on OM Times Radio.